I just wanted to come here. I had a dream about this place.
Welcome to the Infected.
Hi there, and thanks for tuning in to The Infected, your podcast from the heart of darkness. Yoon and I have selected six great tracks for this week that we will play and discuss with you right now. So sit back, relax, and open your mind, because here we go.
Open your mind to me.
Our first band is one of the first and most successful synthpop acts from the UK. I'm talking about The Human League with the wonderful song The Lebanon.
And who will it was? right. So how's that for a welcome to the show?
Well, man, couldn't imagine a better start. Perfect. High energy. Great track by a great band. But I think this is the best song that they've ever put out, Jeroen, in all honesty. Just got the right mood. Yeah?
I totally agree. I totally agree, man. This is by far my favorite from the Human League. By the way, did you know where the name the Human League came from?
Not really. Never thought about it, but I'm sure you can tell me right now.
Yeah, of course. The name of the band, the Human League, was taken from a sci-fi board game, which was called Star Force. One empire in this game was called the Human League. Mm. And the group was formerly called The Future, but like so many of the early synthesizer and new wave bands from the space age, they took their inspiration from science fiction and futuristic entertainment, like this space game.
So, is it a well-known game or is it some obscure stuff?
It's a game by a famous gaming company that started in 1969 and made serious simulations. So they really try to not just make funny games, but be scientific about the way that they built their space games and simulations. A famous company called SPI, and you have to be a bit of a hardcore nerd to like those games. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's good stuff. Good stuff.
Cool. Another science fiction reference. We talked about J.G. Ballard and the influence on the early UK synth-pop and new wave bands. But here's another one, I guess.
Yeah.
Not J.G. Ballard, but a science fiction reference, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
And you know, the good thing is about board games?
What's that?
They're really cheap entertainment, right? You buy a board game once with a group of friends, and you can play for hours and evenings and days on end. You don't need too much money. And that was a good thing because singer Phil Oakey was working as a hospital porter at the time he was approached to be the Human League's vocalist. Mm-hmm. And as he recalls, I was a hospital porter out of absolute desperation. I'd worked at a bookshop for 2 years where the wages were £9.50 a week. At least with portering, I was earning £50 a week. That was the only reason I did it. I was finished otherwise.
Huh, sounds like a good deal.
So,
got it.
Right? So this is where these guys came from. And then the Human League started and they had two really successful albums. And then suddenly the group split up.
Oh, again.
Yep.
One of those stories where groups split up in their early years when they're starting to peak, really.
Yeah.
Or have peaked.
After just two albums. So Ware and Marsh left to form new band, the British Electronic Foundation, which later became known as... You know this?
No.
Heaven 17.
Oh.
So that was half of the Human League becoming Heaven 17.
I didn't know that. Heaven 17 is familiar, but I didn't know this history. Cool. Okay.
Right. And then they left and they formed a new Human League with a bass player and two additional vocalists who were schoolgirls. I'm not kidding you. Phil Oakey first approached Joan Catherall and Suzanne Sully to join Human League in 1980 when he spotted them dancing together on the dance floor in the local club.
Okay, cool. Well, Phil was very good looking back then. He had long hair.
Yeah.
Right now he's bald as a snooker ball, but he was a good looking guy. So he approached these two girls. Okay, go ahead. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, no, neither had any experience or singing or dancing professionally, as Sully recalled in an interview. He came over, he was very serious and said, "I don't know if you know, but I'm Philip Oakey from the Human League. Our group has just split up, but we're contracted to do a tour of Europe in 3 weeks, and we're looking for a female singer. I saw you and your friend together, and I wondered if you wanted to audition."
No way.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's how that went, and that's where the two girls came from.
I think that Phil may be the only then consistent member throughout all the years of the Human League. Could that be right?
Probably, although I'm not 100% sure. Wright might also have been in the group since the beginning. But anyway, the fun thing is, if you look at the music video for the song, it was one of the first things they did. So they went to the Theatre Royal in London in March 1984. And if you look at the video for this song, at first sight, it looks like it's a Human League concert with the band playing live on stage. But actually, the concert was fake. It was staged and it was filmed in takes as the band playbacked to the song. And the audience were just invited extras. And some part dancers were played in front of the stage to make it look like there was an audience. And it's actually very noticeable when the camera pans onto the audience in certain shots, especially where certain of the extras really desperately are trying to move into the shot for their 12 seconds of fame. But it's funny because even though it was a fake concert, the band's appearance on stage is still notable for its layout and behavior. And the three vocalists are in a straight line at the front of the stage. Mm-hmm. A very energetic Susan Sully to the left, a very serious Philip Oakey in the center, and a cool, laid-back, sashaying Joanne Catherall to the right, with all the instruments to the rear. And this arrangement and the performance style was what they always used, ever after, whenever they play live. So it all came together really quickly for the new and reborn Human League with the Lebanon.
Cool. I also know that they've tried to keep up with time. And in the early 90s, when House was coming along, they did a couple of tracks that are quite interesting. I believe there's two that I know of. I can't name them. It's been a long time. But very well put together House tracks that they also did in the 90s, two of them. But yeah, but let's be honest, this is a track that everybody knows the Human League by, or at least we do, I guess.
Definitely. And of course, there was a riot about the song, because the song is called The Lebanon, mm-hmm. because it's about the Lebanese Civil War of the 80s, when the Israeli invaded southern Lebanon in 1982. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of press and politics going back and forth. Oakey said he is in no hurry to make another political statement ever. And he's still wondering whether this was a mistake for his band.
Okay.
In an interview, he was later quoted as saying, "I think the world is so confused that I don't even think you can make a statement. I've often wondered if the Lebanon was a mistake. I'm not so sure groups should do political songs, because I write a few lyrics and then one day the drummer is walking along the road and then someone asks him whose side he is on and starts a punch up. Mm. I sort of think that politics is maybe more for solo artists." Modest pop stars too.
Yeah, but at the same time, ask you too, because they've been very political. They got away with a lot of, I think, statements, but they're maybe more popular statements than this one back in the day, but yeah.
U2 is very Catholic and very religious and spiritual, right? So I guess you don't, outside of Ireland, you don't get shot for being Catholic very quickly.
No, probably true. I don't, I'm not a big fan of politics in music as well, but as you know, I don't listen to the lyrics all the time. It's just so catchy. And those guitar you mentioned when we were listening to this, it was the first time they used guitars, right?
Right, yeah.
In a track.
Yeah, the previous incarnation of the Human League had actually made a statement that they would never use guitars.
Mm-hmm.
And then two members split up and they started over, and all of a sudden they had a bass player and there were guitars in this track. But yeah, everybody must have gotten over that really quick, because it's excellent. That riff is very memorable.
Most definitely. Talking about guitars, let's continue with some guitars, shall we? Because I'm talking about the next band we're going to feature. It's Buzzcocks. They are from 1977, I believe. It's an early punk band, and the track is called Why Can't I Touch It? Here we go.
Yeah.
So this is a slower track by Buzzcocks, because usually they tend to play really energetic, high-tempo punk. What do you think about it?
I really liked it. It's atypical for the Buzzcocks. I saw it them playing live, I think, about two and a half years ago, not too long before the pandemic hit.
Oh, really?
And they are tight, a band that is all about playing with a lot of energy, and they're old men on stage, obviously, because this band is formed in 1975. So
75 even. I was thought it was 77, 75. Yeah, even. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
But that's when they got together officially. I think the first official date was like 76, but they were inspired by the Sex Pistols also from Manchester, and actually they were the ones that invited the Sex Pistols to come over to Manchester to play at that, you know, famous concert, which had only about 50 people inside, and all of them pretty much turned into pop stars.
I remember that story. They were also produced by Martin Hannett, by the way.
Oh, right.
Early singles from Factory, yeah.
Yeah, that figures. No, I really like them. And obviously, I think everybody knows Ever Fallen in Love, which is more the up-tempo sort of work that they usually do. Mm-hmm. But they always were able to find a way just in between the hard punk and melodic pop songs.
Yeah.
Many of their songs have really great hooks and are very catchy, which is more than you can say for most of the punk that followed after the Sex Pistols.
Very true, very true. So I discovered Buzzcocks. I've heard of them before. The name rang a bell, but I've never really heard anything before 2016, to be really honest. So I was working in Amsterdam, really downtown. And during one of my afternoon walks, I stepped into a record store when I was still collecting vinyl. It was on the Prinsengracht, kind of an expensive location, and the store was called Second Life Music. At the time, it was an unorganized mess, small store, fully packed with records, and also a stale smell of old albums, like that cardboard smell or something, you know what I mean?
Hey, yeah, yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
So, and I was digging through all these boxes, and the clerk, he was playing the compilation album Singles Going Steady from Buzzcocks. It's not the Buzzcocks, by the way, but Buzzcocks without the. And, well, I listened to it while I was digging, and in the end, I thought I couldn't find anything, trying to dig for gold, but you don't get lucky all the time. But I had to tell the clerk I needed to own this album. But he was a bit hesitant and bothered, because he had to take it off the turntable and sell it to me. It was also one of his favorites. Anyway, but that raw energy that I was hearing in the background while digging of Buzzcocks, it's very addictive. It never gets old, even to this day. And for our listeners that are unfamiliar with them, Jeroen just told you a bit more about them. Let me elaborate, because they were an English punk band, indeed, from the town of Bolton. They started in 76, 75 maybe, but 76 is the official record. And Howard Trafford, he was a student at Bolton Institute of Technology. And Howard, he placed a notice looking for musicians that shared a liking for the Velvet Underground.
Cool.
And then Peter McNeish, a fellow student of the Institute, responded, and the rest is history. So they are basically the two founding fathers of Buzzcocks. And about the band name, the word buzz stands for the excitement of playing on stage, and cock is a Northern English slang meaning friend. So they thought it captured the excitement of the punk scene, as well as having a humorous and also sexual connotation.
Right.
Following Pete Shelley's time when he was also working at a Bolton adult shop. They were studying and he was working in a sex shop. They thought that was a great band name. It certainly sticks, right?
It does, yeah.
And, well, Buzzcocks, they're regarded as an enormous influence on the Manchester music scene and punk in general, and also stuff that came after punk. And after recording some demos for the fourth album, the group disbanded in 1981. So that's basically, well, 5 or 6 years after they incarnated, when Shelley, he took up a solo career. Anyway, they reformed in 1989. And as you just said, Jeroen, they are still active and play the hell out of a concert room, as I hear you correctly.
Yep, I do.
So during their early years, they had also quite some commercial success with singles, and they merged those singles. They're quite poppy and catchy, like you also just said. Good hooks, let's say it that. Good hooks with a rapid fire energy, except for the track we just listened to, because it was quite slow, but I think it's a very introspective and interesting one. Anyway, all these singles they recorded in the early years, they were collected on an album called Singles Going Steady, and that was exactly the album I bought in that store in 2016. It's a true punk masterpiece. It's also completely available on Spotify. Lucky us. So that's Buzzcocks.
Yeah, it's an awesome album, Singles Going Steady. I also love the name, by the way. And there's very many bands that have done singles compilations, but Singles Going Steady is just, you know, great find as well. I love Buzzcocks, so great choice. Thank you for bringing it.
Perfect.
The next band we're going to talk about is Pink Turns Blue. Pink Turns Blue is a German band, and they started out as a student band, originally found in Cologne by Tom Elben and Mick Jogwer, who was studying bass at the Music Conservatory in Cologne. And the duo was soon completed by Marcus Gilches on drums, who then studied fine arts, and Ruby Walter, the keyboardist, who was working at a factory in Emmerich, a small town where both Mick and Marcus went to high school. So their sound was heavily influenced by their members' love for post-punk bands like Joy Division, Susie and the Banshees, Early Cure, The Velvet Underground, There We Are Again, Killing Joke, Jesus and Mary Chain, and last but not least, Husker Du. Always striving for a deep atmospheric sound with multi-dimensional lyrics, the band had it all figured out, and they chose to sing in English, which was a total disadvantage in the German market, but eventually an advantage to reach an international fan base. So this is the story of how a factory worker and a bunch of students achieved to get a record out and achieve their breakthroughs. The first lucky break that they got was they won a competition with German radio station WDR with songs from their first recording session. The band got to play a WDR festival for newcomers and was discovered by amateur bookers who got the band to play in small clubs all over Germany. Also, the WDR paid for a second studio session in Studio N, a big facility usually reserved for German pop stars. In this session, the band got to play the producer's impressive EMU sampler, which you can hear on the album That Was You. During this session, the band agreed that it would be better to have just one lead singer to sing all the songs, and with the support of the producer, Mick became the lead singer of the band. And then they sent their recording to several record companies, but they were only interested in the German language at that time, because it was the time of the Neue Deutsche Welle. So, tongue-in-cheek, German lyrics, humorous, and the Pink Turns Blue songs were much too downbeat and too dark to get the record companies interested. Only one publisher, Arabella, was interested in letting the band record another four songs in a small studio. During this session, Tom was getting uneasy about mixing his songs. Plus, he got a job at the WDR to become the presenter of Graffiti, a cool late evening radio show presenting new music, pretty much like John Peel on the BBC. So during this session, Tom mentally was already leaving the band, and without a record release, it was challenging to get many people to their shows. So people would often pop by to listen to a few songs and then move on to a club to dance or to have a drink. In spring 87, Tom played his last show with the band and left it without a guitarist and songwriter. Most songs on the album are still credited Elburn and Jogwer, but basically when Tom left the band, the rest had to audition guitarists. And unfortunately, they did not find anyone really exciting. They also had to do a few more already booked shows, and then in the end decided that Mick had to try to play guitar, and Ruby had to take up bass additionally to the keyboards. On some songs, Ruby played the bass with his left hand on keyboards, and on other songs he just played the bass, and they didn't have a guitarist at all, except for the parts where Tom tried to figure out how the instrument worked. Surprisingly, people had more sympathy with the band as a three-piece, and they started to stay throughout the shows, and after 3 months they got offered a record deal by a small independent label in Munster, Fun Factory. The manager was a big fan of Andy Warhol and his factory, and the Velvet Underground, and he did everything to get the band good support, gigs, radio plays and press. He got the band to record a few more songs somewhere near Munster. There they recorded I Coldly Stare Out in This Face. So with all those recordings they cobbled together, some high quality and expensive studios and some made on the cheap, they made an album. And the record came out at the end of 1987 and changed everything for them. People loved it, they started to know the songs, it was different, and fans came to the shows. Suddenly they were a real band. They started getting booked on TV and would go on to have several hit singles in Germany and abroad, and eventually would even move to England. Now this song is from the breakthrough debut album If Two Worlds Kiss. This is I Coldly Stare Out. Thank you.
Count your heroes, acrobatics. Cold fingers forming you. Our songs claim to the night. Just the puppet in the play. A lonesome king calls his lonely crowd. Calls you home into the cave. A cold is out to the sky. To the sky. A cold is out to the sky. Someone's way to someone's mind. To try to hide or try to turn away. You got the chance to save your health. A last chance to learn that there don't be. A cold is the road to the sky. Cold is the road to the sky.
Is it early or more recent? What did you...
It's a debut album, so it doesn't get much earlier than this.
Debut album. Okay, okay. Let me start rambling. So this is a very mature sound. It's very composed. It's very laid back, very well balanced. You got these guitars that are subtly playing in the background. It's got just that mood I'm looking for. But I heard of this band somewhere, but never heard one track by them, at least consciously. This is a good one.
Yeah, you should check out their album, If Two Worlds Kiss. So as I just explained, the songs come from different recording sessions and even with different lineups. There's a couple of real jams on it. They became quite a big band, but I don't think many people are aware of Pink Turns Blue anymore these days. Mm-hmm. The thing is, in this track, obviously the guitarist had already left when they wrote this, and you can hear that the guitar solo at like 2.5 minutes. Many guitarists play too many notes, right?
Yeah. Too busy, too much trying to take the stage. Yeah.
So he isn't the world's greatest guitarist, and he takes his time and is really melodic, and it perfectly fits within this sort of atmosphere that they're building. That's why I like the song.
A composed lead guitarist is very rare. But in all seriousness, this is a very well balanced, nice and moody track from a debut album. I'm also reading up some more information. They put out a lot of music.
Yeah, they were very productive.
A lot. Well, makes me interested in checking out more.
Yeah, there's a lot to discover here. Pink Turns Blue. Look them up. There's loads of it on Spotify as well. So enough to check out.
Very nice and convenient. We like Spotify and all those streaming services. More and more is coming out on these streaming services, because the early days it was more of the like the Britney Spears poppy stuff that was very popular, but more obscurities and rare gems are finding their way through these services last few years. It's very positive. So I'm going to talk to you about Moev, or I'm thinking I'm pronouncing it Move. It's a new band. It's a band from Canada, and they founded in 1981. And in an interview, I read where the name comes from. So it's spelled M-O-E-V, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a color, and the color is Mauve. It's M-A-U-V-E. It's like a pretty purplish pink color.
Mauve, yeah.
Yeah, mauve, exactly. Pink color that's also associated with insanity. So here we go. I'm dragging you down into the dark linings. If you listen to the next track, as we're about to, if Susie Sue would sing in a synth pop band, it would probably sound a lot like Mauve. So it's from their first album called Zimmerkampf. It's a German name. It's maybe called Chamber Camp, if I can translate it into English. It's kind of a, I don't know how to explain it any other way. Zimmerkampf.
Or Room Battle.
Room Battle. That's better. Kampf is battle, and yeah, you're right. Room Battle. So it was only released on vinyl and cassette, this album, the first album of Mauve. Never on CD, and sales were poor. They were soon kicked out by their record label. It's called Go! Exclamation mark. That record label even went bankrupt in the following year. I'm hoping that not only Mauve caused that. Who knows?
So Go! Told them to move.
Yeah, sorry. That's true. That's very nice. Nice pun. The lead singer at the time was called Madeline Morris. She also left the band after the first album. Then they hired another female singer that left after the second album. Then they hired a male singer. What a mess, right? You can't keep up with these guys.
Yeah.
What you also have, if you change lead singers and the band changes a lot of times, you don't have a real solid base to build an audience on. What to expect, right? And also, obviously, the sound, it evolved more towards goth rock and away from the synth pop sounding first album in the later work that they did. But they did manage to get picked up by Atlantic Records in the late 80s, and they had one successful album called Yeah, Whatever. Anyway, nobody probably listening to us right now, Jeroen, have heard of Mauve. But if you were a Canadian that was into new wave and alternative music in the late 80s, you would probably know a few songs by them. But the band was largely overlooked, let's be honest. A constantly changing lineup, like we just mentioned. Sound didn't really help the band grow into a kind of a consistency or a consistent sound. They were on the front line of the new wave and dark pop sounds of the early 80s, but by the time they found their groove, they were losing the momentum, basically, because in the end of the 80s, people were moving on from new wave sounds. They were more into modern rock, so they, well, fell in between. Also, the founding father of Mauve is called Dean Russell. He died in 1994 of the complications due to AIDS, a disease you don't hear much about. It's, I think, well contained these days with the right medications. Also, yeah, but in the late 80s, early 90s, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
But the band broke up after Dean died. In recent years, some of the remaining band members revived Mauve with some new bandmates. And this is just a classic story of... although they are just a footnote in the rich history of New Wave, they got lost in between. I still do like quite a few songs by them, in all honesty, and I wanted to bring them to light in one of the final episodes of our podcast. So enjoy Mauve with the wonderful track Mad Hatter from the album Zimmerkampf from 1982. This is it.
Mauve.
So that was Mauve. Yes, sir, indeed.
Yeah, I liked it. It's also a color in role-playing games. If you have a temple of an evil god, usually the temple is mauve. That's a color that the bad guys like.
The color of insanity and bad guys.
Yeah, so pretty experimental, actually, for a new wave from that era. Interesting combination of guitars and synths. And Clark type spoken word type intro and mixed with the vocals. Very interesting. I liked it.
Definitely interesting. And the other stuff that that did was more, well, it's all over the place. But I think this and maybe three other ones is really worthwhile. But check out the album Zimmerkampf. There's no bad tracks on it.
How am I going to check it out? Is it on Spotify or somewhere?
Well, you can YouTube it.
Oh, YouTube.
Or you can download it, but you didn't hear that from me. I have a really nice P2P downloading app that's very clean.
Well, obviously, if it's not for sale anywhere, it's not stealing, right?
Well, I bought the record back in the day. By luck, I stumbled upon it for a few bucks. They're going for 100 now. I saw on Discogs, so you can probably check it out on YouTube if you want to be discovering more.
Well, thank you for sharing the backup of your album.
Very welcome, my friend.
Which you are entitled to make since you own the album, right?
Yeah, I paid my dues.
Yeah. Yep. But we do promote actually buying the music if you can.
Yes, yes, yes. In all seriousness, we do. And we also pay our fees to do this podcast, by the way. We pay all the, what's it called? The
license fee to the Dutch version of the RIAA.
Yes.
The Dutch one is called BUMA. So we do pay for the music.
Indeed, we do.
If you like a band, if you really like a band, just put them on repeat and play their songs overnight. It really helps the bands out.
True.
A whole bunch of streams for your favorites.
Making this podcast costs us more than we make because we're just pure passion. We got some decent microphones from Rode. Right, Jeroen? We don't go on a cheap. We take it very seriously. We pay our fees, and it's just fun.
Yeah, yeah. So we're not in it for the money. We're in it for the love and spreading the infection. That's why we're here, right?
Absolutely, my friend.
The Infected.
We're going to move to a classic, a real classic. Nutshell by Alice in Chains. Basically, when Mauve had figured out their new wave formula. So by the end of the 1980s, the 90s started, it was the era of grunge. Now, Alice in Chains came out of the Seattle grunge scene, just like Nirvana, Pearl Jam and Soundgarden.
Yeah.
They actually started in 1987, when singer and songwriter Lane Staley met up with guitarist and songwriter Jerry Cantrell at the infamous Music Bank. So this was a Seattle warehouse practice facility for several Seattle bands. Now, Cantrell brought in a recent bandmate, bassist Mike Starr, who then in turn brought in his friend Sean Kinney on drums, and that was that. Now, the Music Bank was open 24 hours. You could go there and knock on the door at 3 a.m. in the morning, and the guy that was working the keys would come, look through a peephole, let you in if you had a room there. They would walk you to your room, unlock it with the key, and this guy would have a huge key ring with about 150 keys on it, and then you were good to go. So Lane Staley, the singer of Alice in Chains, was one of the key guys, and he usually worked the graveyard shift. Jerry Cantrell, the guitar player, was living in our jam room, so in the middle of the night, Jerry would be in the office with Lane, watching TV with his guitar in his hand, saying, "Hey dude, check out this riff. I got this idea." That's how it all started.
Hmm.
Their debut album, Facelift, was released in 1990, even before grunge was recognized as a genre, so they had to open for bands like Van Halen, Anthrax and Poison. Their live shows were full of energy, but they quickly got the reputation to be a difficult band to manage, partially because they didn't want to play along in the celebrity game. They all but refused doing interviews, which made them really unpopular with the press. One story I like is about Jerry Cantrell. He likes to go on extensive hunting trips, sometimes for days at a time. Once, when Alice in Chains was touring with Van Halen in 1991, they had a few weeks off before the tour would resume in Memphis on December 2nd. Alice in Chains never made the show, because Cantrell was on a hunting trip and he forgot that November only had 30 days.
No way.
Yeah,
to
make sure it didn't happen again, Columbia Records gave him a calendar.
Oh man, what am I doing in corporate life? I should be in a band and then hunting and oh, damn.
Yeah. So about this song, Nutshell. It's a song by Alice in Chains, which originally appeared on their 1994 EP Jar of Flies. It was part of their famous 1996 MTV Unplugged performance, and although never released as a single, despite not hitting any US Billboard chart or any chart around the world, this song still today is one of Alice in Chains' best known songs and it's considered a staple of 1990s alternative rock. The song is notable for its emotion, acoustic instrumentation and the electric guitar solo. Bass player Mike Inez said, "Lane put everything he had into this song. And in the lyrics." So, this song was written after the band had been out touring after the release of their 1993 album Dirt. When they finally came home to Seattle, they found out that they had been evicted from their apartment in the Music Bank, since they had failed to keep up on their rent. All their stuff was out on the street. They had to move to another studio and began working on some new music, which then became the EP known as Jar of Flies. Check out the lyrics if you can. This is Nutshell.
Infected Classic.
Can I be honest with you?
Yeah.
I always thought I've heard of Alice in Chains, but I skipped it because I thought Alice Cooper. Call me stupid. I don't care. I can make myself vulnerable. It's okay. But this is the first time I've heard this. This also reminds me of that really great track you put onto my radar, I Wanna Be Adored. It's Goosebumps. Slow build up. You got some highlights during the song, but subtle. I wouldn't want to call this grunge per se, but their other work that they did probably falls into that category. But it's just really nice and melodic song. And you asked me to listen to the lyrics, and they got kicked out. Is he saying my privacy was raped or taken? Or
yeah, my privacy is raked, is what he's saying.
Raked. Oh, not raped, but raked. Okay, yeah, taken away from me,
yeah.
If you will. Okay.
Yeah, I'll take you through the song because basically this is a song that only has 8 lines of lyrics, and Lane Staley put his whole life into it. The first 2 lines are about the many tough press releases and stories about the band, from members' lack of professionalism to their fame, which they found hard to deal with. The first 2 lines are, "We chase misprinted lies. We face the path of time." In these first 2 lines, Lane uses "we," referring to Alice in Chains, and how they stand and struggle together in the face of bad press, adversity and despair. In the next 2 lines, Lane gets personal, expressing the gravity of his drug addiction and the loneliness that comes with it. And yet I fight this battle all alone. No one to cry to, no place to call home. No one to cry to refers to the feeling of loneliness of being on the road, and also the personal demons Lane had been battling at the time, alone. No place to call home refers to the fact that they'd been kicked out of their apartment and were basically homeless, as well as Lane generally feeling that he doesn't belong anywhere. Now, Lane felt this perhaps more acutely than his bandmates because he felt he was to blame. His battle with addiction was his responsibility and his alone, but it affected the band as a whole, with tours and shows having to be cancelled. And then the next 2 lines both refer to issues Lane is experiencing, but caused by 2 very different sources. My gift of self is raped. My privacy is raped.
That's where I got the confusion. Yeah.
The first, my gift of self is raped, refers to his drug addiction. His dependency has raped his ability to be himself, and there's nothing he can do about it. The second line, privacy, is about the media publicizing his addiction. Throughout the 90s, the media openly publicized his issues, both true and false information, compounding the issue. And yet I find repeating in my head, if I can't be my own, I'd feel better dead. Frontman Lane Staley died in 2002 from a drug overdose, alone in his apartment, having not seen anyone for weeks. He'd been dead for some time when his body was found.
What a sad ending. Such a talented guy, troubled by addiction.
If I can be my own, I'd feel better dead.
Hmm.
I guess it's a true feeling that you feel coming through in this song.
Yep.
It's not all fun and games being a pop star.
No, usually I'm bobbing my head when we listen to the tracks we discuss in this podcast. But right now I found myself laying back and closing my eyes and being a bit more introspective. Powerful stuff.
Powerful stuff indeed. Sorry to take you down.
No, not at all. Because I got some track to light us all up again.
Ah.
In the end, the final track is a fun one.
Cool.
But this is also a part of the genre that we like. This falls into the category, my man. Nothing wrong with that.
Thank you.
So, to discuss our final track, I got a fun one. It's by Celibates, and it's called Coming Alone from 1981. Let's listen to it and then discuss it very briefly, and then I'm really looking forward to that 8-bit minute again. So we're gonna listen to some fun track, got a brief story, and then go on to the competition, shall we?
Yeah.
Here we go. Is this a hot and fun mess or what?
I really like this track. It makes you smile. Put me right back up on my feet. And I love the little sounds, the right. And the psst and the you know, it's just na-na-na-na-na. It's almost childish, but it's still the repetition sticks in your head, but it doesn't become irritating. And it's actually quite an achievement.
Yeah. I couldn't describe it any better way. So you got some echoes going on. It's fun, but that you got that chorus that's kind of a bit aggressive sounding, but still fun. And then you got that light hooks. It's a fun mess. But also within the, I guess, post-punk realm that we like. So if you're into the early 80s minimal synth and new wave sound, you're in a treat with these guys with Celibates. A band that consisted of Terry Sullivan, David Kane and Kent Webber, three guys. They became one of Buffalo, New York's first original synth-based pop trios, playing sold-out shows at the Continental and many West New York colleges. They're basically like a obscure college punk band or something, I don't know. They only did one album. I couldn't dig up any information at all without trying really hard. They recorded one independent LP, A Shameless Fashion, and that's also where this track is on. It was recognized and rotated, lightly in the New York area. And I think these guys managed to mix powerful and dark passages with some fun lyrics and some fun catchy hooks with some lightness overall, but still a lot of balls, if I may say so. And that's all the background I could dig up on them.
It's a typical Hofjack because you manage to come up with these acts that nobody has ever heard of, and they actually make a great song, at least one. I haven't heard anything by Celibates, obviously. Yeah, it's you're surprising me again, man.
Good to hear, bro. But seriously, I've never heard of these guys up until maybe 2 or 3 months ago. I just thought I'd pick this out for this week. And hopefully our listeners can discover something new. Eh? That's what we like to offer. Some classic bands, great music, and also some obscurities and light stuff.
So I was thinking about their band name. You know that many bands start out because they're boys that are trying to get girls. Yeah, and they think that if you're on a stage, you stand a better chance. I was thinking the name Celibates might have been part of that strategy, where it's sort of a challenge to the girls to turn them, right? So we're the Celibates. Oh, you're a celibate, are you?
Let me convert you.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so it might have been part of a great master plan, which which they were trying to get working. Also, something that fits very well with the 8-bit minute.
My favorite section.
Yes, because for the spectacular ending to this great show, we have some fun and goodies to reward you. And first of all, a treasure trove is awaiting you at the website, theinfected.nl. Check out the stories, pictures, the show notes, links to the video clips of the tracks we've just played, and access a number of exclusive interviews and mixed sets by great DJs like DJ Dieter from Belgium and Max Weemoed from the Netherlands. And while you're there, pick up some merchandise. We have awesome hoodies, phone cases, and trendy t-shirts. There's free shipping, exactly, with the code INFECTME, and we don't make any money off it because the amount of stuff we get to produce is so limited that it's all creation and the shipping is all that we charge, just for fun. So, anyway, on to the last episode of our legendary 8-bit minute. How would you like a The Infected t-shirt? You can win one right now, because this is the final part in the 8-bit minute competition, where you have to recognize the song and artist you hear in an 8-bit version. Last week's solution was, yes, Everlong by the Foo Fighters. This week's challenge will be the last 8-bit minute. Send in the right answer to win the random winner prize, or even the season prize if you're a regular contributor. If you recognize the track you hear right after this, let us know via Instagram, our website theinfected.nl, or mail us at theinfectednl@gmail.com.
8-bit minute.
So, children of the night, which band and song do you hear in this 8-bit minute?
Thank you.
Thank you.